Welcome to Complementary, a series covering the principles and practices of interface design hosted by Katie Langerman and Anthony Hobday. Today we're discussing what takes interaction design from good to great.
The countdown was off-center, which is weird.
Was it? I wasn't looking at it.
It was partway into your frame. I've got the two frames side by side.
Okay.
Partway into yours, so it shifted right of the... I guess they don't want to put it in the center because there's a break there. Maybe that's intentional, but it feels odd.
We're going to have to do like a visual design breakdown of Riverside as we use
on our podcast.
Well, today we wanted to discuss what takes interaction design from good to great, which I think is pretty interesting. I can talk about like good interaction design, I think, but going from good to great, I think is very specific, and it's a very Anthony topic if I do say so myself. So I'm glad that you are here with your notes and ideas of how we can take things from good to great and kind of dig into that one.
This is why I find it, part of the reason I find it so fascinating is because you can find lots of articles that talk about how to make for good interaction design, but there are some things that you sort of learn over time, or you see someone else do and you think, oh, that's fantastic. And people don't, to take it from good to great, people generally don't write it down, which I find quite frustrating. So yeah, I think this is a me topic just because I find that frustrating. And so I make sure to go around and note these things. Whereas most people sort of, I suspect some people treat them as almost a moat around their skill set. Like, I make great interaction design, I'm not going to start writing down my secret sauce for other people.
Yeah, so it sounds like a lot of this you've kind of picked up from your just observing designs. Like, you spend a lot of time looking and trying to figure out what it is about designs that you like or don't like. And so at that point, you can start to see and differentiate between good and great.
Yeah, and it's incredibly easy. If you just spend 5 or 10 years writing down things you notice in really good interaction design, you too will have a list in your head.
Easy. It'll take no time at all.
No, I guess that's the one thing it does take is time, but it's incredibly easy to just pay attention and then write them down. But yeah, you pick it up slowly that way.
Right.
Which is why books are so great, is that people take the time themselves and then write it down and then share it with everyone. So I wish there was more of that, but hopefully this podcast will.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll help speed it up a bit here by breaking it down. So what should we start with?
I think we should start by saying that the title is important. From good to great means that we're not really going to cover many things that make interaction design good. Like we said already, you can find that online relatively easily. There's been books written about interaction design that talk about the sort of foundational rules and concepts. But so this is going to be a sort of a random assortment of things that, like you say, I've noticed in really good interaction design. And it might not be complete, or it almost certainly won't be complete, but we haven't also got enough time to be complete. 2-hour special coming your way.
Wow.
So that's why it'll seem like we're out on the edges, on the fringes almost.
Yeah.
But the first thing I wrote down was that things that should look like they act and act like they look. And I think this is teetering on the edge of good and not great. But it's important because, I mean, people talk about how a button should look like a button, right? And that's relatively standard. But I see a lot of relatively well-designed applications or interfaces that actually don't take that advice, and they don't go in and make sure that everything that looks like it can be clicked, right? Mm-hmm. You may be talking about shaving half a second off in terms of someone's understanding of how an interface can be interacted with. But those things add up. I generally call them paper cut problems, which is not my phrase. You've probably heard it before. But if every element in your interface takes, 10 milliseconds longer to understand how it should be used, especially the first time, then that's just a worse interface. It builds up over time, and annoys people. So I guess that's like an auditing problem of, let's go through every single one and figure out, is this as clear as it could be? Does it look like the thing it is supposed to be? Does it act like the thing that it looks like? I'm having trouble thinking of examples apart from buttons.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me is related to buttons, but it's more around buttons that look like links and links that look like buttons. And I wonder how that fits into this, because that is it seems like a never-ending issue for designers making links, like thinking about adding a button to an interface and then the engineer actually builds it to be a link because it's a navigating change and not opening a dialogue or like doing an action. And that can be due to many reasons. It could be a communication problem between designers and engineers, not understanding how the actual flow is meant to work. It could be a limitation, a technical limitation. It could be that the designer didn't think about it at all and just put a button there because it feels like an action, but it's actually navigating. And then I think some people would argue that it doesn't actually matter. And I think it might not matter for apps, but for web, it does matter, I think you could say, because it's sort of confusing if you have some buttons that complete an action and other buttons that actually navigate you to another page. I feel like that's not great interaction.
Yeah. And that I wrote a sub point here, which is lines up quite well with that, which is that it's better to match expectations than to be consistent. Because a lot of the advice you'll find about interaction design, interface design in general, is that consistency is king, or consistency is the monarch. And that's actually not always the best idea. If someone's got an expectation that's different from what your consistent design will deliver, then you shouldn't be consistent with yourself. You should be consistent with what they expect. And so if someone clicks on a button and expects it to take them somewhere else, then, I'd argue that's fine. But as long as they haven't sort of learned that it does that from your interface, they haven't had to learn those sort of idiosyncratic approaches you've taken. If someone thinks that an X or like a cross symbol will always close the thing that it's sort of sitting on, then you should pay a lot of attention to that expectation. And regardless of what you want your interface to be consistent with.
Mm-hmm.
But I should say that often those two things are the same. Often what's consistent is what matches expectations. I don't mean to suggest that there's no overlap there at all. There's a lot of overlap, but there's little situations where you have to be careful.
Right. So it can be just consistency within your own application or product. But there is also, I don't know if we're going to talk about this, but also like utilizing existing paradigms outside of your own product, like to match expectations of what users are used to and comfortable with. But for something like a button, buttons look, I mean, they have the general same shape on all websites for the most part, but they look so different depending on your product that I'm not sure it matters too much if you're like, it would be strange to say all buttons need to look identical across products to match expectations.
Yeah. I guess the much worse problem is when people style something that looks like a button and it isn't. It's just inactive or non-interactive.
Yeah.
Sometimes, or underlined in text that isn't a link, you know, that sort of thing. It really annoys people. Well, it doesn't really annoy people. It annoys people enough when they go and try and click on an underlined piece of text and find out it's just there for emphasis, that those things really add up. And so it kind of limits your options in terms of emphasizing text, for example. But then again, limited options are a good thing in the world of design. They lead to more creativity.
Mm-hmm.
The next one I've written down was useful animation. And there might be some unpacking necessary here because I think everyone appreciates that, not everyone, most designers appreciate that animation can be good. But I think in a lot of cases, people include animation that's not useful or necessary. And it just sort of helps to make the interface look more sort of bouncy or fun. And I'd argue that sort of detracts from how useful animation can be. And so if you want to let someone know that something is interactive and you make it jiggle slightly, I'd argue that's, I mean, it's quite a sort of branded animation in terms of making your interface feel whimsical. But I'd argue that's quite useful because it's letting someone know, oh, you can interact with this thing, or you might not have noticed this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you make things jiggle when people hover over them just because it's fun, that's a bit less useful, even though it still has the whimsy, you know.
Right.
It's not got a sort of a purpose behind it. And I think if you only use animation for purpose, then as soon as there's movement on the screen, you know that someone's being drawn to that for a reason. It's not just, oh, isn't this interface fun? It's, oh, okay, I didn't realize that thing was there, or I now know a bit more how I can use it, or maybe something shifts slightly to let you know that you can drag it. I'm always like a big fan of those, and I see them quite rarely. if there's like a card that you can drag between columns or something, maybe when they first load in, you sort of shift them all slightly and then back the first time they see it. That sort of thing can really, really help people sort of get to grips with the interface very quickly.
Mm-hmm. I feel like poor animation design is worse than no animations at all. Mm. I think I said that backwards. No animations is better than poorly done animations, in my opinion.
It works both ways. And I agree with you 100%. I always prefer to not use those, let's say, advanced things until I have a reason to. And the reason should be a good one because, you know, it's hard to develop. It's hard to design, especially if you want it to feel good. And so why put the effort in unless you're going to get a lot of benefit out of it?
Mm-hmm.
And it can distract people. It can make people think there's something important about whatever's jiggling around when actually there isn't. And so it's also dangerous. It's not just, oh, we put the effort in and it hasn't really helped, but it's not going to hurt, because I think in a lot of cases it does hurt if it's not useful animation.
Yeah. Kind of like one thing that comes to mind are like dialogues opening and closing. I think having a nice animation on open is pleasant. It's a pleasant experience. But if it takes forever to close it, it's like the opposite of what you should be going for, or like what you are trying to achieve. Because if someone's trying to close something, they want it to close probably very fast, if not instantly.
They're sort of already looking for the next thing. And so you're getting in the way of that. One thing I quite like there is, wait, it slipped my mind. You were talking about, it was animation speed. So
yes.
One of the standard sort of standard rules is that it should be less than, I think it's 0.2 seconds or something. Like, it should be under a certain amount of milliseconds. And I think designers, they might spend, you know, a couple of days perfectly tweaking an animation. And at that point, they want it to be the star of the show because it's taken so long. And maybe the developers on board with that because they've spent so long tweaking it as well. Maybe they're really proud of their work and everything. And so that's dangerous, you know, is designers wanting their work to be the star of the show means that they probably will not make it as quick as it should be.
Yes, I'm guilty of that. Designing like a check mark for a checkbox that checks in and out, you could spend like a whole day just like fine tuning and it looks perfect after. And then at the end, you realize nobody wants to wait for their check mark to come in as they click this checkbox. No. Oops, waste of time.
We have got something later on in the list that's sort of contradicts that. So it's interesting that there are some tensions in this list.
Okay.
But I think they're all valid. You know, I guess it's part of it is knowing when it's valid and when it's not. But related to animation, sort of, is I struggle to find words to describe this, but it's quite common in the best interaction design is, well, sort of the basic approach is physical or spatial consistency. And so if something slides in from the right, it should slide back out to the right. And so that gives things in the interface a sense of place in terms of, I know where this is coming from, therefore I know where it's going to go away again. And interfaces often sort of ignore this. I can't think of any specific examples, but if you slid something in from the right and then made it disappear on close, then that's sort of, it's not got a physical or spatial consistency. And one term I've come across for this, which I quite like, is either object constancy or object permanence, in terms of if you treat every element in your interface like a physical object, then you should try, if you can, to have those physical objects act as if they are constant or permanent in that interface. And so when they are dismissed, they have to actually go somewhere. And so that relates to animation, because often you're animating these things around the interface.
Hmm.
And if you do it right, it really gives someone a sense of physical understanding, spatial understanding of the interface. And a good example of this is the as yet unreleased family crypto wallet designed by, name is Benji Taylor and team. And I'm not into crypto, which bothers me because
you can't see the app.
Generally that team designs sort of the best apps in terms of interaction design in the industry. And every app they've designed has sort of not stuck around. And so I think, you know, if crypto doesn't stick around, then Family, the crypto wallet app, will probably also not stick around unless it pivots in some way, which will be a shame because they put so much effort in. And luckily, they've recorded a lot of high definition videos showing how things move around the interface. And it uses a lot of this constancy or permanence for elements in the interface. And it's really satisfying. And you know, people notice this sort of thing. It jumps out at people. So it's also just impressive if you want to impress people. It's not just good interaction design, but it is importantly good interaction design.
This also kind of makes me think about responsive design, where, like, I think maybe old school responsive design.
Old schooler, I think.
I'm having trouble speaking today. Old school responsive design would kind of just hide things like Bootstrap. You would have the ability to just display none stuff, like for mobile design. Mm. So you'd take your desktop application and then make it small and just hide a bunch of stuff. I feel like that kind of relates to this because it's so easy to just hide a bunch of stuff when you're working on responsive and smaller viewport windows. But yeah. The great, like a much better interaction is to keep everything available and think about like how do you keep it available and still have like a sense of permanent space of where it could be. Or maybe it's that it always there is like an overlay or a window that's always available on smaller screens for that type of behavior. So I think it's really hard. I think that's what would make it great is that it's a kind of a challenging problem to solve.
You can imagine, and this would be so much effort and it would only be seen on a rare occasion, but I think the design community would basically riot out of joy if someone pulled this off. So someone who's listening could try and build it maybe. But you can imagine that responsive design if you had, let's say, a list of icons in like a toolbar type thing. And then whenever the screen shrinks, they get moved into a more menu, like a three dot, here's everything else you're missing menu. But if you basically, as someone's shrinking the screen, if you animated that behavior of those icons moving into that more menu, it would be hard to do it in a way that's not slow and annoying, but you're giving someone that sense of object permanence where they're seeing where those things are going. And so if they're working at a smaller screen size, if they've seen that animation before, at least, they know to look in that more menu for the, oh, this thing's missing, I can go over here. Mm-hmm. I think people learn that sort of thing just because it's quite a common pattern. But I think the first time someone's using an app, you know, if you were sort of animating them jumping into the little menu.
Little then, menu eating each item one at a time.
Oh, yes. Like Pac-Man, sort of it opens its mouth and then eats the icons. It would stick in your mind forever, I think, especially if you're a designer.
Yeah.
You could walk into any company. But yeah, it would only be seen when someone resizes the window, which is, you know, usually when you're resizing a window, you're probably not paying attention to the interface so much.
Yeah, just the designers and engineers who sit all day resizing windows.
Yeah, maybe just work on it as like a something to attach to your job application.
Yeah.
Rather than something for a real interface. But yeah, it's that sort of thing. Like it's hard to pull off when you do, and it takes a lot of work, right? A lot more work than it's probably worth. But when you do, it usually contributes a lot to it being great interaction design.
Right.
You mentioned responsive design, which is not, that brings me to my next point, but not really, because it was speed or responsiveness. And speed is so important to good interaction design. And that seems like such simple advice, but so few pieces of software do speed properly or responsiveness. And that's really frustrating. I mean, I think a lot of designers have really high-end devices, like they're all on the latest iPhone and they're all in on MacBook Pros, whatever. And so that means they're not really experiencing the interfaces or the software they're working on when it's slow. But it's extremely frustrating. I remember reading an article I could share with you. We could put it in the show notes. But it's basically, it had an anecdote in it about how they developed a new piece of software for EMTs, I think they're called, the people who ride in the ambulance.
Uh-huh.
And so people go and pick up someone in an ambulance and they load them in the back of the ambulance and they have like an iPad equivalent in there. And they've got software on there where they can fill out some details and it saves filling out paper forms. And I think it sort of got the details ready for when they arrived at the hospital, right? So it's saving time. It's all for a good cause. But no one used the iPad thingy because the software was slow and it would take like a second for each screen touch to do anything, or half a second. And it really adds up and people get so frustrated with it that they just don't use it and they fill out the paper forms, which is probably losing money and it's wasting paper and it's losing time. It's got all these problems, but paper's extremely responsive. I don't know if you've checked it out recently. But,
what is
the refresh rate is incredible.
I don't know if I have pens or any. I don't know where I have to grab a pen. That could take some time.
Yeah, hopefully they stick the pen on the clipboard or whatever with a fraying piece of twine. But yeah, that speed and that responsiveness is incredibly important. And I think because people are generally working on high-end devices when they build software, they're not really focusing on it enough, which is a real shame because you can just be the fastest piece of software in your industry and probably get a lot of goodwill and word of mouth marketing through that.
Yep. That's a hard one for design through the design lens, I think, because you in many cases might be at the mercy of whatever tech stack is being used in your application. And right now it's JavaScript all day, every day, all JavaScript, which is slower for sure. But there's so much new stuff coming out, like the page transitions API, which gives you like native support for making your web apps feel more like kind of an application by transitioning between views without a ton of JavaScript. So I think the future is, well, I don't know. It's kind of tricky. There's like some people are in the camp of trying to do less JavaScript and more native web stuff. That's typically going to be better browser support for poor internet connections. But then there's also tons of support for JavaScript frameworks and like using more JavaScript for stuff, which slows everything down. So I guess from the design lens, would you say you have to think about those like states while things are loading and how to show that something is happening as the page is loading really slowly?
Yeah, the common advice is that you can work with the perception of speed rather than speed itself. And I think it's almost a fallback because ideally you'd have speed itself. But if you go to any company other than Google, basically, and try to say, okay, but let's make it so that they can search through these millions of records in a split second, you sort of get laughed out of the room the developers sit in. Although it's not a room because it's 2023, so it's an open plan office, or everyone's got their own room because they're at home. Uh-huh. But yeah, you're laughed at, right? Because you basically need, I'm assuming Google, that's what they need all those shipping containers in the sea full of computers for, because they are basically using like thousands or millions of computers to make search results fast. And like you say, it's all on JavaScript and everything. If anyone wants really fast interfaces, they find out often that there's some kind of technical decision that was made 5 years ago before they even turned up that means that it's impossible. And so, yeah, people often say the perception of speed because, yeah, if you can show loading bars, for example, that's at least telling you something about what's happening. Whereas if you're just clicking a button and then waiting and nothing changes on the screen, that's bad. But even loading bars, you know, when I've gone to developers and said, oh, we'd like a loading bar that basically accurately counts how long it'll take because that will really help expectations. They're like, no, we can't do that.
It's not
so possible. Why not? It's like, because we don't know how many records there are, you know, before. We'd have to go and do the search before we could show them the loading bar just so we could tell them how long the search will take. It turns out sort of 90% of the progress meters we've had in our lives have been lying to us.
Oh, yeah. So
strange.
This one is complicated then because there's some design stuff you can think about, but also the better solution is probably to think about what can we do to make this actually faster, like how can we change something about this search showing results, like grabbing a quick snapshot of the results before everything is fully loaded, pagination, like various kinds of things you can do in that scenario. So that's going to be one I think that needs a lot of communication with engineers.
Yeah, I think companies, the best thing companies can do, which is not helpful to all the existing companies, but right at the start they can say one of our core sort of founding principles is that it should be fast. And then you can set things like a performance budget. I remember hearing that Gmail, when they started, basically developers couldn't add anything to Gmail that would slow the interface down.
Uh-huh.
And I'm assuming they measured it in milliseconds or whatever. I suspect that has not survived the test of time, especially as tech stacks have changed. I imagine that one was too hard to stick to.
Yeah, I agree. I think it rarely works. I think usually working on speed is a result of having a really slow site that you're now trying to fix to make faster. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear about a company that has that from the very beginning. Maybe newer companies do that are starting fresh with their whatever tech stack they want to be using. But And we have more tools now to measure these things. At least we have a lot of tools from Chrome, which is not everybody. Not everyone is using Chrome. So it's still helpful to be able to measure those things. And I think that's having it as part of the browser, like being able to run those tests is more accessible for designers to check out what's actually happening. So
yeah, especially if you can point to something and say, you know, this is worse than all of our competitors. That's probably a helpful thing, even though it's awkward in the meantime. But earlier I saw, you know, someone had shared a link to their portfolio and said, I've just finished working on this portfolio. Could people check it out? I went and looked, and they'd had a lot of great ideas in terms of high-end presentation, like visual design, high-end interaction design, quite flashy, but it was extremely slow, and I'm working on an extremely fast laptop. And so there was like a marquee, which should be a simple thing to get right, but the marquee was sort of jittery and not scrolling smoothly. And it was that sort of thing, and I think scrolling was sort of jittery as well. And these are really basic principles of interaction design, is that things should be smooth, like scrolling should be smooth and everything. Because it really bothers people, even though it's a small thing, it gets on people's nerves. And so I thought about giving them the feedback about it, but I didn't really have the heart, because probably it's based on all of the decisions they made up front about how should I build this thing. And generally the way to fix those sorts of speed issues is you can't fix them. You have to just get rid of everything and start again and go with a simpler approach, because those things are hard to fix. Like that's the annoying thing about why this seems so simple, but actually it's hard to do well.
Yeah.
But on a more positive note, another point I made here, which relates to responsiveness rather than speed, is interruptible animations. And this is one of those ones that people rarely talk about. But I heard from what is now a legendary WWDC talk about, I think they called it fluid interfaces, or I gave it some name. It was people talking about the ways that iOS feels responsive and good to work with. And one of their points was interruptible animations. So we were talking earlier about how if a designer puts together a great animation, they want it to play out because it looks so good. But actually, while it's playing out, people should still be able to interact with the interface and maybe tap something else. And so you should be able to interrupt that animation, especially if you want to cancel it. It should sort of unanimate, if you see what I mean. It shouldn't just finish and then have to go back, because that takes twice as long. That sort of thing is also extremely hard to get right, but people feel it when it's sort of not there. They start to get frustrated. The annoying thing is people don't feel it when it is there. If animations are interruptible, it feels completely natural, because that's how the real world works. And you just ignore it, basically.
Yeah.
After, you know, 2 months of work, whatever, to get it right.
Well, I always think that's a good thing, is when you don't notice something is not so noticeable. That's usually a good thing, because it just feels more natural. But it might be hard to pinpoint it as somebody looking for a great interaction design.
Yes. I should remember all these things I've talked about, because otherwise I'm going to forget to send them to you.
Well, guess what? This is being recorded, so.
Oh, good. I thought it was just a fun conversation. The next one is sort of related to interruptible animations, but it's called Fiddle Factor, and I don't know where I heard this first, but I generally think it's a good sign that if people are playing with your interface just because it's fun to use, then that's great interaction design. And I don't mean, like I said before, useful animation is important. I don't think you should put things that are fiddly in your interface just for the fun of it. But I think if you tap a button and it's responsive and fast and it animation finishes really quickly or whatever, but it's still fun to press, then that's a good thing. I think if someone can fiddle with your interface and have fun with it, then and it doesn't get in the way of anything else, then great. And this is the sort of thing you often see in really good interaction design, because they care so much about the details that they want to make sort of every element fun to tap.
Mm.
I think that the best example of this is Tinder. That sort of revolutionized the world of sort of
the swiping
playful apps that are for a purpose. And so that swiping, it made it feel like a game, right? And so it had real fiddle factor in terms of getting people engaged. And they didn't really have to do that much, because people are already engaged with the idea of finding a partner.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a fun thing to do in some ways. But they layered on the extra sort of fiddle factor. And now that I'm talking about in the context of dating, the word fiddle doesn't sit right with me.
Oh, man.
I shouldn't have used that example.
I do think this is like, it feels more relevant to apps, like phone apps that you're using your hand to play around with. I guess it could be this way on desktop too, like maybe thinking about project management software where you're like dragging things around and moving things and organizing and sorting. I could see like some fun interactions in that, but I definitely notice it more on web app or on mobile apps. Like I have, you know, like 7 social media apps now for Twitter replicas, and one of the Mastodon apps that I was trying that I can't remember which one it is. It's the big one that everybody really likes. Yes. There were some fun interactions with that that just kind of make it like, I think that's the app where if you open an image, it kind of like, and you close it, you like swipe out to close it. It sort of like falls over a little bit. It has like a cool animation to closing it. It makes you want to interact more with the app.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things can be really fun and I guess like help elevate the overall feel of the app.
Mm. I like your example of project management software because often things happen in columns. You're moving cards around. And that's such a physical interaction that it's good to consider whether you've got the time to make the interaction feel more physical in ways we've been talking about before. And so if you grab a card in the middle of the, at the top and then drag it, maybe it should essentially pivot around where you've grabbed it and act physically like
it's dangling.
Yeah, like it's dangling from your mouse, right? I mean, you have to be careful because if you grab it in the corner and it was acting purely physically as people would expect, it'll sort of dangle down and be basically vertical again, and you won't be able to read it. So you need to sort of be careful and fine tune it and see what feels natural, but is not sort of harming someone's interaction. But that sort of thing is also a fiddle factor in terms of, oh, it's fun to move cards around.
Mm-hmm.
Same with things like if you want, there's this principle that if you want someone to do something, make it easy. And if you want someone to not do something, make that hard. Or make the good thing easy and the bad thing hard, right? And that comes from interaction design, but also things like training horses. You sort of, you make them feel good about what you want them to do, and you make them feel bad about what you don't want them to do. Just like we train horses, we train our users to use our application. And so if something like setting statuses isn't happening enough, or adding tags or something, the more sort of fiddle factor and fun you can add to the idea of adding tags, the better, right? Because then someone would be like, oh yeah, I get to add tags now. They can be excited about it every time rather than having to be reminded by their manager, like, oh, the reporting's really bad and that's because no one's setting any tags. So everyone set tags or you'll lose your bonuses.
Hmm.
That's not fun.
But also being careful about like making sure the interaction you're applying is appropriate for the case. So like we've seen, my manager always talks about this example of like confetti. Like sometimes a page will show confetti after you've like accomplished a task or something. Like that could be cool if it's a positive task, but it would be weird if it was just kind of a mundane task or even a destructive task to show like confetti. Mm. But if you're not actually considering that and thinking about it, I could see it easily happening just because somebody thought it looked cool and they want to use it everywhere.
Yeah, you just paid for life insurance. Congratulations.
Wow. Yeah. Industry definitely is going to impact how much like whimsy you're going to have in your animations.
Mm. And so it's interesting to think about how far you can take it. Like what's the appropriate limit? And then how can we make the entire interface feel really good up to that limit? And so maybe things do feel a little bit more sort of squishy or have a little bit more fiddle factor, but it's not to the point of confetti, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Just because those things help you understand how the interface is all working together. And that's beneficial to everyone, right? In every industry. The next one I'd written down was context awareness, which is quite big because our devices are filled with sensors these days. And so a common one, which I guess is pretty standard, and that if you develop for iOS, for example, it's generally taken care of for you, is that you can use sensors in your phone, like a light sensor, to dim the screen when it's really dark or brighten the screen when it's really bright, if you're outside, for example. And those sorts of things are taken care of by the operating system. But if your app can use sensors in a similar way, then you might be able to sort of understand the context that the app is being used in and then make it even more useful to the person who's using it.
Hmm.
I think we did talk about an example a few episodes ago where people on Twitter were developing this idea of the camera was used to make surfaces reflective.
Yeah.
I think if you did that sort of thing, there might be ways you can use that to improve interaction design or improve understanding. Like if something really deserves someone's attention, or they've got a special award for something, maybe you could use that sort of reflection layer to show them that thing is special. I suspect most people will use it for things that aren't important to the person, but that are important to the company, which is sort of the wrong way to go about it, but keeps the lights on, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I feel like privacy is a huge concern with that. I wonder if there's a way to, I don't know, maybe we'll start seeing ways to utilize that kind of technology without needing your camera on on your phone at all times.
If we just stop asking permission for people to access people's cameras and microphones, yeah, then we can start doing this cool stuff. Like, you can, that's with the camera. I sort of imagine you could say, oh, if someone gives you access to their microphone, maybe you can tell that the room is really loud. And maybe you could make the interface rely less on sound, if it was relying on sound, and sort of improve the visual feedback. Ideally, it would have good visual feedback in the first place. There might be cases where actually sound is an important part of your app. But if you can tell that it's a loud room, then sound can't be as important and you should take steps to.
Yeah. I think some attainable ones for like web apps in this category are just like offering dark mode or high contrast mode. Things that hook into operating system defaults, or even offering more customization within your app for users. Like if they want all of your website to have a certain font size or even a certain font, like you could kind of really push the boundaries here of like how much customization you want to offer, which really makes the experience individual, which I think if it's done right, could be pretty impactful.
It's a bit wild to think that, let's say 10 years ago, things like dark mode weren't really a thing.
Yeah.
And now it's completely normal that macOS figures out that it's a certain time of day and then changes the entire operating system to dark mode. And then most of my apps also are tied into that and say, oh, macOS has changed to dark mode, I'll change to dark mode too. And so suddenly all of your screens sort of go a bit darker, which is good because the lights are off, whatever. That's good interaction design because, like you said, they've become aware of the context.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it's just table stakes that an app needs to pay attention to the dark mode preference and how that changes to match the system preferences. Yeah, that's a relatively new thing, but it already seems like a requirement, which is an interesting shift.
And doesn't seem that difficult, really. I don't think it's not a huge lift. Well, it's a huge lift to create dark mode of your app, like design wise, but actually implementing these things is actually very simple now. So,
I had a point here that sort of brings us back to the idea that speed is really hard because of decisions that were made before you started working on the interface. And it's that one of the common approaches to good interaction design is that you should not ask someone to provide the same information twice, but like if they type their name in, you know, and then they go to a separate second screen, don't ask them to type their name in again. You know, that's just showing your org chart basically, like, oh, you sent your name to this part of our organization, but now you need to send it to this part. But some people do it so that you don't have to enter it once. And what I mean by that is, I'll give an example. When I signed up for I think it was my driver's license, but maybe it's both ways. I signed up for my driver's license on the UK government website. And you go through, and they care a lot about interaction design, and you go through a relatively simple process. And at one point they say, okay, we need a photo from you, but we notice that you've already got a driver's license with us. Do you want us to use your driver's license photo for your passport photo? Or vice versa, I can't remember which way it was. And you just tick yes, and then they go and fetch it because they've got that information elsewhere in the government. And that's not really an interface designer decision that has to depend on people who are overseeing the whole thing and saying, no, we've got this information already. We're going to share it across all the departments that people might need a photo for, and then provide that information to the user when it's relevant. And so that's really good interaction design because I don't need to go and dig out a photo or send it off through the post or whatever. It just gives me what I need because they already have it, but in a different department. And so that's like next level.
Wow.
So you can do that within the interface itself, but you can also do it sort of within the company. Or if you've got access across government departments even, you could do it across government departments. And that sort of thing is world-class, but it's extremely hard to pull off because you have to go outside of the interface. The designer can't just put that into their requirements and suddenly the whole company reorganizes and sort of creates cross-department data sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what are the chances? You sort of need to set that up in advance or have a big project to get it through all of the requirements gathering steps that I imagine must go on at government.
Yeah. I'm just really distracted by like how easy that process sounds in the UK to get a passport. My God. It's not the case here. It's not the case. I don't think any of the government people, like none of those sectors know about each other. It's all separate.
Mm. And it's an interesting one because the UK government has this department called GDS, which is Government Digital Services. And I think a lot of other countries model their government tech departments around GDS because GDS is quite good at it. But they're centralized and they have strict rules and they enforce them strictly. And so everything you build to this new standard has to go through GDS for approval. So they're keeping like a watchful eye over it. And they're really sort of militant about it, which it turns out is what's required for good design. They care so much about good interaction design because they're having, you know, 70-year-old people for the first time, whatever, to sign up for X, Y, or Z because they want to get rid of paper forms. The interaction design has to be incredible. And so that's sort of what it takes is for someone who cares so much about it to say, no, this isn't good enough, do it again. And if you don't have that, then a lot of these things will be basically impossible to get through.
They have a great design system. I'm assuming that we're talking about the same thing, but it's a design system that is often referenced in the community as world class. Like they really think through everything and it's extremely usable and accessible.
The one problem is that the people who have worked at GDS and really taken it on board, they become extremely evangelical even once they've left. And they end up becoming like the world's number one evangelist for helper text under form fields or something. They just are on that point forever for the rest of their lives.
Maybe we need people like that.
I think we do. Yeah, we do. Yeah. It's just like in a lot of companies, that sort of thing is, they can't do it like GDS does. And so it's probably frustrating more than anything. It's a good thing if you want to advertise GDS as a place to work though, because you can see like, oh, these are the standards they stick to. I want to work for GDS.
Right.
Oh yeah. So that was context awareness. I think you can take that really far. And I think some companies or platforms try and take it far in terms of AI or guessing like the time of day. You see that actually one of the things I use all the time that I really do sort of depend on sometimes is if you hold an iPhone close to another iPhone that is trying to connect to the Wi-Fi network, you can share the password with a single tap. And so you don't have to type in the weird long Wi-Fi password that most people do. That sort of interaction design depends completely on context awareness of, okay, there's another iPhone nearby. It has the password. I'm going to ask them if they want to transfer. And they just announced that sort of business card exchange interaction at WWE's DC. So it's that sort of thing that you can only do if you have that centralized control that impresses people.
Apple definitely has. Yeah. Another example of that is like when you're trying to sign up for something and you get a code texted to you and it shows the code like within the window of the input that you're focused on, so you don't have to open the message. Very nice. Like that's one of those very subtle things that really makes, it speeds up the entire interaction dramatically.
One of my favorite memes is that people keep, well, it goes through waves. People post that on Twitter with a screenshot as if it's a new feature. And they're like, this is the best thing Apple's ever released. Whoever designed this should get a raise. And it's always like the same text. And it's the same few people, I think, that do it once every year or something. And then there's always replies beneath. It's like, they've had this for years.
I'm pretty sure.
I think it was released yesterday.
I think Android has also probably had it. I'm not going to say longer, but it kind of is usually the case that these things were in Android first, but I'm not going to start that war.
No, it turns out Android had everything before iOS did. It's been years since I've used an Android phone, but I suspect they unfortunately could not put as much time and effort into making it flawless.
Yeah, like there's flaw for sure. It's like they take the tactic of let's just ship it and get it out there, see what happens. And Apple is like, we'll sit on this for a couple of years and then people will forget that you guys did it first and then we'll just do it better. That's fine.
I've only got one more point, which is probably a good thing because we're running quite long. Turns out when we talk about great interface design, it goes on for a long time. But the last one for great interaction design is that you should have great visual design. And I say this because people often separate the two, but there's a huge overlap. And I think basically everything in visual design is there or will have an impact on interaction design. And so one of the ways you can improve your interaction design is to really focus on your visual design, because visual design is what helps you understand what things mean and what they do, even things like where you should look next. And so not just a static view of something, but how you go through an interface over time. You can set sort of foundations early on and then follow through with them later so that people are like, oh, this looks like that thing I saw earlier. So I know that it does this. And a simple example is like, you know, if every destructive button is colored red, right? That's a visual design decision, but it means that you can associate that color with that concept and you know not to click a red thing, you know, unless you want something bad to happen, or something destructive to happen, I should say. And so I think it's hard to get great interaction design without great visual design is the general point there. And obviously we don't have time to talk about great visual design today.
Part two.
Yeah, just go and make your visual design great and that's the last step.
I had that same destructive button example in my notes because it's kind of hard to enforce. Like, it's also sometimes hard to quantify what makes it destructive. Is it that it's opening a dialogue telling you that something destructive is about to happen if you press another button? Or does the destructive button need to actually do the thing, like delete something that's permanent or whatever? And then you could even take it a step further, like, should you have something that's permanent that you can't undo, or should everything be able to be undid? And then you're not talking about design anymore. You're talking about like the actual product and the functionality and the like much larger scale view of how everything interacts together. So
I think we should spend at least 5 minutes talking about the word undid.
Okay.
Because I don't know if you meant to say it.
Is that a word?
Or if you still believe it's a word. Did is a word, but did. Undone is
undone.
The past tense of undo.
Listen.
But I think I prefer undid. What did you undid?
Words are hard today. I don't know.
Yeah, no, words are always hard. We shouldn't say that in the podcast business, but there you go. I think another good example is, well, another good point maybe is that for great interaction design, sometimes you have to sacrifice some visual design options or decisions. And one thing I always really appreciate when people commit to it is that if you only use color for meaning, interaction meaning, then that can really help. Or if you only use, let's say, depth effects. So if you had an interface where the only color you used was blue and the only time you used blue was to show that something was interactive, or if you only use depth effects when something's interactive, that's really hard to commit to in terms of visual design. But it helps tremendously in interaction design because then someone can glance at a screen and know immediately where everything interactive is, because something like a color is extremely easy to spot amongst black and white. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of thing requires the visual design sacrifice, but it leads to great interaction design because everything's immediately clearer. And so it's hard to ignore how they interact in those terms. I mean, between interaction and visual design.
Yeah, unless they're colorblind. Then you might need to not rely on color alone. But
well, if you're only using one color, then you can pick a color that everyone can see.
The high contrast.
Unless they have monochrome, unless they have the type of color blindness where they can only see black and white, in which case, yeah, you might need high contrast color that stands out in terms of visual weight. But I think if your color choices are limited, then to one, I mean, then you can do a lot with color still because it will stand out against otherwise monochrome. So that's everything I had on my list. There's probably more, but
I mean, that was
already
great.
At 50 minutes.
Yes, I wasn't expecting that. That's great. I think this is a really cool conversation. Lots of good ideas, hopefully some actionable things. I think a lot of what we discussed, definitely you can apply to your own work. Challenging maybe to apply to existing products in a huge organization.
Yeah.
Like anything else.
Yeah. There's probably some things in here that you do have complete control over, you and the developer you might be working with, or if you're the designer and developer, fantastic. Some of these things will depend on the foundations being set right. And some of these things, I think, will depend on the decisions you're making today. And so you can at least focus on those, right? And take it from 50% to 60%.
Yep.
That's still good.
I think for myself, I want to try and pay closer attention to these interactions in other designs that I'm looking at, similar to what you do, and just see if I can spot things, especially things that are really subtle. Figure out, like, what was good about that interaction that I didn't notice that might have been happening? And see how I can pull that into my own work.
I think a good one is in iOS, especially if you do sort of screen transitions in apps. If you're swiping in from the left-hand edge, you often can control the speed of the transition because it's based on the speed of the swipe.
Right.
And so one thing I like to do is if I notice something interesting is happening, I basically slow that swipe down with my finger. I don't have to record it and then play it back at half speed or whatever. I can do it with my finger and I can see how some things are fading in and some things are fading out and some things are moving up and down. And you see really good interaction. You also see things that look good when they're quick, but they make absolutely no sense when they're slow. And so that's another interesting point, I guess, is that you can get things that feel good, but actually don't make any sense. And maybe that's okay. You know, maybe it's a valid approach.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, thanks for sharing all of these great tips. I think this is a cool conversation.
It's fun to talk about.
Yeah, it is fun to talk about. This is the fun stuff. Interaction design.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening this week, and we'll catch you in the next one.
Bye.